welcome to the recordings of the Oldies Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club, kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.
Our next speaker, Dr. Rowan Williams, was the 104th Archbishop of Canterbury from 2002 to 2012. He was the Bishop of Monmouth and the Archbishop of Wales, the Master of Magdalen College, Cambridge. I think he might be the only person in the world who's written more books than Ian Wilson. At my latest count, I could be wrong, Andrew's done 51 and Rowan, you've done 53. So time to catch up. And his latest book is Solidarity, the Work of Recognition. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Rowan Williams.
Thank you so much, Harry, and thank you all for coming to celebrate together. It's been a great delight to be part of this association before, and a great delight to express my debt to the Oldie for their crossword, particularly. As an addict of cryptic crosswords, I do find it one of those I turn to very regularly, so keep up the good work. My wife describes some of the books I've written over the years, rather more than I thought, actually, as taxi driver books. That's to say, the kind of book that consists of someone turning their head around saying, and another thing. Not particularly well organised. And the trouble with a book that's taken quite a long time to write, like the Solidarity book, is that over the 10 years or so when it's been brewing, a lot of ideas have been flowing through. And that shows. But I'll try to condense what I was most wanting to talk about in the book in the next 5 minutes or so, as best I can, and begin with the very, I think, very acute question of what exactly is it that makes us recognisable to each other as human beings? It's the sort of thing that comes up these days when people talk about AI, isn't it? How are we going to know if and when AI becomes conscious? Will we recognise consciousness? Soul, even, in it. It's not a new question, because over the centuries, especially since the 16th century, there's been quite a lot of worry about whether all apparent human beings are really human beings. There's a great debate in the middle of the 16th century in Spain about whether the indigenous inhabitants of the Americas were actually human beings of the same kind. A century later, in Protestant Virginia, there was a very considerable public argument about whether slaves were really human beings. And as soon as you start setting conditions about rationality, liberty, self-control, as the conditions you have to meet in order to count as a human, the worse things get. Somewhere behind all this is a fundamental recognition, hence the subtitle of the book, The Work of Recognition, a fundamental recognition that when I meet somebody who looks like a human being, I assume I can talk to them. I assume I can talk to them, and I can understand what they say. It'll take a lot of labour, work of recognition, but it's the assumption I work on. And human society, when it's doing its job, is making that task of recognition just a little bit less difficult and stony than it might otherwise be. So the book begins by looking at some of the history of those issues. But it moves then to two notions, which are interconnected but not exactly the same. Okay, so we recognise each other. We sense that when somebody speaks, they're speaking from a hinterland, not completely unlike my own. And that's the foundation of what we like to call empathy, which in the last couple of decades has become a very fashionable concept indeed. There's a not very good book, I'll spare you the title, which says any problem immersed in empathy becomes soluble. I feel I want to say good luck with that, really. Empathy is not of itself the full story. Fellow feeling isn't everything. And those of you who remember the sainted Prunella Scales and Sybil Fawlty, her greatest theatrical creation, will recall Sybil on the phone saying, "Oh, I know," to her friend. Somehow we have to get beyond a notion of empathy that's just the Sybil Fawlty level. And that, rather surprisingly, without reference to Cybil Fawlty, was picked up by Pope John Paul II, probably not a regular watcher of Fawlty Towers, when he said in one of his encyclicals, "Solidarity is more than fellow feeling. It's more than a warm sentiment. It's something to do with a recognition, not just that someone else is having similar experiences to yours, it's a recognition that their similar experiences to yours are the foundation of things to do together. They're foundations for a kind of trust in other people that allows you to work together. And so solidarity is, at one level, something given. We are all interlocking in our experience and, as it were, overlapping in our experience more than we often imagine. But solidarity is also a calling, a summons to behave in a certain way, to build the possibilities of common work and common trust." Pope John Paul, of course, had a background in and with the Solidarność movement in Poland, the solidarity movement of the trade unions in Poland, which helped to overthrow the communist regime in that country. And one of Pope John Paul's friends and associates in Poland was a priest and a philosopher who played a very significant role in the solidarity movement. And there's a whole chapter of the book about him. His name is Józef Tischner. Not very well known in Britain. Not much of his work is translated, but there's more to come, I can promise. And what he says about solidarity in some of his addresses to trade unionists in Poland is, first of all, we have to try to imagine a form of solidarity that is, as he said, without enemies. We need to learn how to cooperate without the idea that we are cooperating against someone. We have to have a solid sense of who we are that's not entirely determined by who we're not. And how does that happen? It happens in the context of work. We have things to do together. And, as he says to the dockers in Gdansk and the union leaders in Krakow, what happens in work is that we recognize not only something in common, but something different and complementary in others. And in working together, we find a common language, a common activity that binds us and that doesn't need an enemy. If you're a shipbuilder in Gdansk, you don't need to define your skills and your task of shipbuilding in opposition to steelworkers in another city. You have a job which defines where you are and what you're doing. And in that process, what develops is what he calls, it's an interesting word, fidelity. Shared work involves a commitment to one another. You need each other to do what you've all got to do together. And you need to be able to rely on one another. You need to trust the people around you. So solidarity without enemies, a solidarity of shared work, and a solidarity of commitment and trust. That's the kind of thing that we're looking at here as the outworking of the recognition that we share a human condition, or even a human calling. A human calling. And the last bit of the book, the last bit of what I want to say, is building a little bit of a bridge from that into my home territory of theology. A calling. We're summoned by whatever it is that creates and shapes us. We're summoned to something other than just naked opposition and rivalry. We're summoned to do something together within a world of which we are part. We don't stand at arm's length from it. We learn a solidarity not only with other human beings, but with the world around us. And that's what, theologically, people mean when they talk about communion. So the last bit of the book is really from solidarity to communion. The vision of communion, which is a vision of a human community in which we are all taking responsibility for the growth and well-being of each other's humanity. We're a long way from that. And it doesn't need me to tell you that none of this is going immediately to win elections on either side of the Atlantic just at the moment. But, in the immortal words of more than one national leader in the last few decades, what exactly is the alternative? if the alternative is simply a state of unceasing rivalry and unceasing suspicion and struggle for hegemony, in what sense does that become good news for any community, not least those who are on the losing side? And when we're faced globally with a whole range of problems, including migration, climate, pandemic disease, exactly how are we going to promote and secure human well-being if our default setting is always competition? A former Prime Minister, a category expanding by the hour, former Prime Minister talked about the need to have a world-beating system of inoculation in the early days of the COVID pandemic. I wanted to ask, why exactly world-beating? If that's the model we're working with, somebody's going to lose. What might it mean to think of a model for the well-being of the human community that didn't depend entirely on winners and losers? That, I suppose, is the question the book wants to leave you with. I'll do just that. Thank you.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.